Welcome to Reboot Republic, the podcast that goes behind the headlines and looks at the big issues in this republic of inequality. We are the podcast of solutions and the podcast of hope, and I'm your host, Rory Hearn. And I'm joined this evening by Anthony Flynn, councillor and CEO of Inner City Helping Homeless, and by Alicia Nealon of the Dublin Inquirer. This evening, we're talking about the homelessness crisis, both on the streets of Dublin, our capital, and across towns across this country, but also the thousands who are in emergency accommodation and the increase in the tragic deaths amongst homeless population. And also, importantly, the solutions in terms of addressing this homelessness crisis. We welcome you to Reboot Republic. To our listeners, remind you, we need you to become a supporter of ours and go over to patreon.com. And importantly for our listeners, homelessness is one of the key issues that they're concerned about and angered about. And many people across this country are saddened that tonight on our streets, people are sleeping in tents, cars, in parks, in freezing temperatures. Anthony, maybe you could set out just what are you and your team seeing at the moment these evenings on our streets?
I suppose over the last couple of days, we've activated contingency measures in terms of the cold weather. You know, we've been forecasted very cold weather, and everybody knows that the temperature has dropped over the last couple of days. So we've seen a reduction in the number of people that are sleeping rough over the last number of months. We're down from about 160 to an average of about 80, 85 at the moment. And most of those, out of those 85, about half of those would be entrenched and would be, you know, people that need long-term solutions in terms of housing forced and intense case management. But, you know, the others that are out there are flagging issues such as, I suppose, antisocial behaviour and drug use and discrimination and intimidation in the hostile environment. So over the last couple of days, we've been working intensely through day services and increased outreach services and through the day to try and encourage those individuals. And, you know, I know you said the podcast of hope, and normally I'm the negative Annie when it comes to homeless services and identifying some of the problems. But, you know, some of the good things over the last week, we did see an increase in terms of bed availability. You know, we've linked in the new director of services, or acting director of services, I suppose, being very forthcoming in regard to what is available at the moment, and the deputy chief Brendan Kenny, particularly over the weekend. You know, our teams have been working night and day to try and encourage people in, and we've been averaging probably about 4 or 5 people a day that have accepted beds that wouldn't normally do so. So that's a good thing. But I suppose, you know, we look at those that are not accepting beds. Obviously, that issue of people that are being that have been entrenched for a number of years, but in particular, those that don't want to go into bed because of, I suppose, the systemic fails, and, you know, people that don't believe or trust in the hostile environment, particularly the private emergency accommodation end of things. It was admitted previously by the deputy chief that the private emergency accommodation providers don't provide the same level of service as those that are in the charity sector, the NGO sector. So I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done over the coming days. Tonight, you know, getting in tonight, the temperature has gotten an awful lot colder over the last few days. There's definitely a concern and a worry for those that are refusing beds. They're being checked in by our outreach team in particular up to 3 times a day. That's without, I know the assertive outreach through Simon are out at night time as well. So, look, I think the main focus is to be no deaths and people don't die. And, you know, we are getting that message to people that it is going to get very, very cold. And there is a chance that people will die over the coming days. But it's encouraging to see that that some of those have come in. But I suppose it's disheartening to see those that don't want to win because of the failures within the system.
Yeah, no, that obviously is, you know, hugely positive to see that drop. And if you're saying people are taking up, you know, hostel beds, why is that change taking place?
Well, look, I think the last cold weather snap that we had, you know, what we done was we put in place a system in Blair Kevin's where I think we brought 80 or so people in, and we put them on ground mats on the floor. And look, I argued the point about Merchant's Quay and I suppose the suitability of bringing 25 people in on each floor and having 75 people in the building on ground mats. You know, I don't believe it's humane. It's you know, we shouldn't have a system where, you know, we've all these hotels, we've all these hostels, we've all these B&Bs, we've no tourists. Well, you know, I think we're the only country that has so many people coming into the country at the moment. But, you know, in regard to the hostels, they're empty, and so are the hotels. So, you know, it was pretty simple for the DRHE to go out and just get a unit, put that unit in place and have a unit with own door facilities. Now, today, we had some issues with regard to individuals that I suppose didn't want to go into units with people that are, you know, multiple occupancy units. And it goes against chief medical officer's advice as well. You know, we have somebody that's been out on the streets for a number of months that might be taking up a bed, and then they're being put into a room with three or four other people. And there's no COVID test being done before these people are being brought in either, you know, which is a worry, that a lot of the people that are in these hostels have been in the same environment for whether it be a number of weeks or a number of months. So like, there's still failures there. But, you know, look, it's cold, it's freezing. Anybody's been out there the last couple of days. Mm-hmm. I mean, we activated contingency measures on Sunday. And, you know, I went in at 12 o'clock on Sunday morning, and it was absolutely bitter at 12 o'clock on Sunday morning. And every night the temperatures have dropped. So people that are out there are feeling that. But I also think that, you know, the good work done by the teams, with the outreach teams are working on three different shifts over the day. The phones have been going up to 18 hours a day for the last couple of days. And, you know, that's a massive, massive effort from a primarily voluntary agency, and, you know, having to put that level of people in place to manage that. But, you know, you've had the likes of Geraldine and Avril and all of those, and the team leaders, Mary Mockdad and all that are out there the last couple of days. And these are people that will coax you in. If you're going to come in, you're going to come in for these people. You know, they know what they're doing, they know their job, and they've been doing an absolutely fabulous job checking in over the last few days. And then those that don't want to come in, they're checking in with them and making them comfortable, because again, we can't force people to come in off the streets, you know.
Yeah. No, and it's what has happened around the issue of that was highlighted on the RT Investigates program of people, you know, not being able to declare, you know, or not being clear if they didn't come from Dublin, that they were being turned down beds. Is that still the case, or has that changed?
Well, look, it's changed to an extent. And I suppose, look, myself and Alicia will be talking about this on a weekly basis. And in particular, you know, we work very closely with Medicity and Louisa there. And, you know, over the first couple of days, we had got a problem. And that's not to say that I think it's married into another problem now in terms of the activation of the extreme weather protocol, because this was something that I spoke to the minister on last Friday. And, you know, although the minister had stated that, you know, bed availability for everyone, and he tweeted tonight about it, you know, anybody that wants bed availability, there are those barriers where there's questions being asked before anybody is allowed a bed. And there's an argument having to be had from my point of view and from other service providers' point of view about the eligibility around bed availability, for the eligibility around bed access, first of all, and people that may not be from the country or may not be from the area, not having a habitual connection to the area. You know, people are still being asked about a local connection. But in terms of the emergency response, over the last couple of weeks, we are seeing that more people are being able to access a bed on an emergency basis on that day, and then having to do the paperwork maybe the next day, or having to link in with an organisation in terms of getting the paperwork done, so a proper registration. So look, it's not ideal. It's not an ideal system, but it's a better system than it was 4 weeks ago. But how long it took us to get to there, you know, how many arguments we had to have with management, how many times I had to ask the minister, you know, your letter is not good enough. You need to pick up the phone and speak to Brendan Kenny and tell Brendan Kenny this needs to be done, and everybody that needs access to a bed. And look, I'm not the only one that was out there, I suppose, banging that drum. There was an awful lot of other people, but yeah, you know, this has been going on for years. You know, an emergency response is not an emergency response. If people that need access to an emergency bed, it's taking them 5 days or up to a week to get one. Mm. That's certainly not an emergency response. But look, it is better than what it was, but we're not working in an ideal system, in my opinion.
No, clearly not. And I did, just before I go on to Leisha, in terms of, you know, the research and the work, investigative work she's been doing around this, and particularly the homeless deaths, I just wanted to ask you, because it is always important when we discuss homelessness, to highlight that, you know, the majority of people who are homeless are actually in different forms of emergency accommodation, mm-hmm. be that B&Bs, hostels, you know, family hubs. You know, we still have thousands of people in that situation. From your working, and I know you work with families and individuals in that situation, you know, how are they experiencing, you know, COVID and this lockdown at the moment?
I suppose, look, I get daily reports from the team, and you know, one thing that's very difficult is you have an awful lot of people that will mail you on social media and send you messages through, and we don't get to see all of those. You know, there's a system, and you need to follow that system. You need to contact the office and make sure that you're being linked in with, you know, a caseworker or a key worker. And over the last couple of weeks, some of the messages that I've seen that have come in from people that are in emergency accommodation, even today, where the team had to go and get the guards to get involved in a case because the person had threatened to commit suicide. And what we've seen over the last year in particular, in 2020, was that increase in debts. But people are very down. People are begging to get out of that system. And some, I suppose, form of light and hope was that, you know, an awful lot more properties came back on the market in terms of, HAP availability and holiday rentals that were in Airbnb units and whatever else. And the council use this as a backdoor in terms of moving people and shifting people from hostels and hotels. And I don't believe it was the correct thing to do, because what I do believe is that if you're singing this tune about the economy going to be opening back up within a certain amount of time, well, all of those hotels and B&Bs and Airbnb properties are going to want their properties back, and they're going to want to be putting them back out there to the tourist market. And, you know, the council stating that people have now got on-door access to units. You know, we're hearing people now coming to us and saying that some of the units are not up to standard. And, you know, we've always had that problem. But there's a dark, dark cloud over homeless services. And there has been in particular over the last 6 months. And I think it's getting worse to an extent where you have young families, that are locked up and being told some of the attitudes from some of the providers and the way. And, you know, I heard something being said at the council the other night where another councillor raised an issue in regard to how a provider had spoken to a client or a family. And the deputy chief had stated that he hoped it was an isolated incident. And I know it's not an isolated incident. The way in some ways,
what were they saying?
The way families are being treated and spoken to and being treated like second class citizens in some of these private emergency accommodation providers. One of my own staff was abused yesterday at the door of a private emergency accommodation unit when she transported an individual to that unit by a staff member there. And she came back and said to me, you know, how she had been spoken to. And I understand everybody is under pressure. But the fact is, we've asked people, you know, people are now living in one rooms. And like we spoke about this before, Rory, where we had hotel rooms with 3 and 4 children in a hotel room and a mother and father. And you have a toilet in that hotel room and your bed and clothes and everything else is there. You were able to bring kids to school. You were able to drop them off. You were able to bring them to creche. You were able to, you were able to go and visit the grandparents. You were able to travel outside of 5 kilometres. You're not able to do any of that anymore. And it really, really is heart-wrenching that when you're listening to some of these families and some of the case management reports that come back to me, of families that have been locked in hotel rooms and B&Bs for weeks and months now on end. And people don't realise that. People are not realising the fact that we look at our own bubble and yourself at home with the kids and, you say, well, geez, it's tough. This is really, really tough. And everybody's situation is. But for these people, they've got absolutely nothing outside of that room. And meals being delivered. It's worse than prison, because people are allowed out their cells and they're allowed to go on a walk. People are being told in these B&Bs that you're not allowed outside of your door and you're not allowed to go down and use a kitchen facility or a family room, because of fear of cross-contamination and stuff like that. And meals are being dropped onto the outside of the door of the rooms, and you take your meal in and you eat in the room, and then it's absolutely heart-wrenching to see the people will be put in that position. And we understand we're living in a COVID world, but we've got to learn how we do this better. And again, not to be negative about it all the time, we have seen an increase in the number of units that have been made available. But we're working in the wrong direction, because what we're doing is we're over-relying on the private sector and the private system to provide social services for us. And that's exactly what it is. It's a social service, it's a social setting. And, the longer we provide, or the longer we keep looking for these private providers to provide these units for, the more money we're going to pay out. And that system will just blow at some stage. Mm-hmm. They want their rooms back for the tourists. So,
yeah. Thanks, Anthony. I think that's a very important point to consider and think about, that you're absolutely right, these families. And I remember the work I did with the homeless families in the hubs even, and the challenges and difficulties that in hotel rooms, and I see it myself, as you say, trying to manage kids at home, in a house, how it must just be impossible trying to manage those situations, and so hard for parents and for the children as well. And I think as well, it is really important to highlight that and to understand that this drop in numbers of families who are, declared, been designated as homeless, where are they going to? And we need to understand that. Are they going to secure long-term homes? Or as you say, are they going to short-term where they could be back into homelessness again? And that needs to be looked at. Leisha Neelan, in terms of the issue that, and I suppose it does link in the whole quality and the problems with emergency accommodation links into the issue of homeless deaths, because you wrote about this in your article about the links, for example, to mental health, you know, people, you know, feeling suicidal and the deaths, and it not been clear where those deaths are coming from. But what have you found in your work?
Yeah, I suppose, Rory, it's just like you were saying there. I mean, it's the idea of living in homeless accommodation at the moment, it just doesn't bear thinking about, because it's so much worse with COVID. And like, I think we all know that, you know, the walls are nearly closing in on you in a normal time in the house. Like, so it's, it's obviously, it's terrible for people at the moment. It's hard to track exactly what's causing the deaths. So there is some research being done into it. There does seem to be an increase. Like, there is an increase in the number of homeless people who've died in 2020. And I think even since the start of this year, that we're still hearing a lot of deaths. So it's, yeah, it's trying to track that. There's two pieces of research going to be done into it. There is the Health Research Board are going to look at the deaths for 2019. And they're going to get the coroner's reports and look at the cause of death there. And also, Dr. Austin O'Carroll is trying to do a piece of research on 2020. Now, the problem is the coroner normally writes the report about 2 years after the person dies. So, unfortunately, it could take a while to kind of get that data collated. And then the other query we were kind of trying to look into was whether or not that would be enough to meaningfully tell us what led to the death. Because obviously you have the cause of death, but there could be a whole load of other issues in the run-up to that. Like, for example, now, without naming any names, you know, there was a man that we wrote about previously, and he died in a private emergency accommodation facility this year. And he had been trying to get mental health supports for years. So, you know, it's hard to say precisely what are all the factors that would lead up to somebody dying, if it's a sudden death, like a suicide or an overdose or different things like that, you know, if drinking was a cause, you know, we don't know if the DTs was relating, you know, you hear somebody took a heart attack, well, you can take a heart attack in the DTs. So do we know whether or not their drinking kind of directly led to their death? The story that I wrote about was recounted to me by Louisa Santoro, the CEO of Mendicity, and it was a client of hers who had been trying to get help for his alcohol, but he wasn't entitled to access detox services, and he wasn't entitled to access supported accommodation in hostels either, because he wasn't from Ireland and he didn't meet the local connection rule. I don't know how it worked on the, that's why he wasn't entitled to the supported hostels. I don't know what way it works with detox facilities. Maybe Anthony knows more about it, but it seems that she couldn't get him in to rehabilitation for his alcohol. And, you know, sadly, he passed away. So there's very complicated reasons, I think, behind the death. So it's important to see if the research can get as much detail as possible. Like, another tragic case that I haven't stopped thinking about is a young girl of 19 who died in emergency accommodation, private emergency accommodation, in the summer. And she is thought to have taken her own life. And, you know, she wasn't getting any support. She was in a non-supported hostel and she was only 19. So I suppose there is a lot of questions, yeah. And it does link in the quality of the accommodation and the quality of the supports that are being provided may be part of the story. We don't know for sure, but it could be part of the story of why some of the deaths happened or why it's increasing.
Yeah, no, I think they're important points, and it is important that, you know, they're focused on. Anthony, in terms of that, what's your kind of sense of it, you know, working?
From anecdotal evidence, the on the ground, it's certainly that there's an increase in terms of people that have died through suicide in homeless services, particularly in 2020. You know, I questioned the deputy chief on the deaths so far in January, and he committed to coming back with a report on that. But I think we'd already 6 deaths within, you know, the first couple of weeks of January, which, you know, was not a great start. But, you know, we have to remember that we've been in lockdown more or less since last March, and an awful lot of those suicides would relate to the fact that people are You know, in situations where they're not able to go out and visit family, they're not able to access the supports that they would have normally supported or been able to access within terms of meeting with, you know, whether it be mental health advisors or you know, clinicians and stuff like that. And something that, you know, we'd have forum yesterday in Crow Park with the with the police and Department of Justice in regard to another issue, and you know, something that we had raised was that, you know, a lot of agencies are being funded, and you know, I am going to be critical, because when you don't see the on the ground response in terms of, you know, the implement, like the, that particular person that Louis or that Leisha spoke about that didn't get access to services, and you know, we were talking about the increase in crime in the city and stuff like that. And children not being able to access services. Like right across the board, we have services that are being closed down. We need to reignite how we supply services, or how we're able to engage, get people to engage with services, because particularly over the last year, you know, people haven't been able to access their doctors the way they were. People haven't been able to access their mental health advisors or supports and stuff like that. And I know of a lot of people that weren't able to access, you know, detoxification programs. And something I've seen, particularly over the last couple of weeks, is the forcing of putting people on methadone programs. People are being forced into these programs. It's the only option to a detoxification or rehabilitation. And that, for me, is not something that I support whatsoever. I don't think we should be forcing anybody into a methadone program for life. I think we should be looking at what other holistic ways or what other supports we can put in place in terms of detoxification. But one unit in Donegal costs something in the region of near €7,000 for 12 weeks. You know, anybody that's in homeless services can't afford that money. But the availability to access and those kind of specific need programs just hasn't been there. And you know, like the availability for beds wasn't there at one stage. You know, we seem to be, again, harping the same tune in regard to people that have lived lives of inequality. And it's systemic. And over the last number of months, I think that the increase is there in deaths because of the fact that, now, look, COVID has played a big, big part. You know, people may have had underlying health issues and stuff like that. But at one stage, we had 3 deaths in one female unit. Leisha, if you remember that, you know, 2 people in that week died of suicide and 1 died of natural causes. In a week, 3 people in one unit. That's just not... And again, the minister committed to investigating. You know, we've heard nothing back from that. You know, last couple of weeks ago, we went out and before we actually got the figure of 79. And like we myself and Leisha even kind of came back and forward in regard to how many people died, because how they worded their own statement in regard to deaths, they didn't give you an actual figure. So many people died here and so many people died there. And like we were coming back and forward in the chat and saying, well, is it 74 or is it 79? Like, you know, they were all in homeless services. It doesn't matter whether they died in, you know, a homeless service unit or on the streets or, you know, waiting in the waiting room of Parkgate Hall. All of these people died in homeless services. And the way they broke the figures down, it was confusing for even us. But we had put the protest outside the door only a couple of weeks beforehand, identifying 56 people in November had died. And we found out in December that it was actually 79. And we were like, Jesus, where's all these other people come out of?
And Leisha, just in terms of that, the figures and, you know, trying to get a sense of what's actually happening here, is it, why do you think it's so difficult to get these figures? And is it a case of, you know, that they're trying to downplay the problem, or they're not, the problem hasn't been taken serious? Or is it, you know, what is the issue, do you think?
Well, it's, yeah, I suppose in terms of the death, they come out in dribs and drabs. The information comes out in dribs and drabs. It's not initially said, and then it's only when somebody like Anthony finds out about a death and they go back and they try and get it confirmed, and then it's sort of stated. The counsellors get reports sporadically now, more so due to people pushing for it. They're starting to get reports. They, in the report, they seemed to differentiate between people who they said were known to their services and people who weren't. In the people who died on the streets, obviously, because all the people in hostels were known to their services. So 8 people died on the streets, and I think they were making a point that 3 of them weren't known to homeless services. I'm not sure if that's really entirely the point.
Yeah.
The report...
The report
it's called report number 10, I believe, and I think, you know, before the former director finished up in December there, I'd sent a number of questions, and I've never had it in the history of the council where I've seen we've been deferred to a report. When you put in your 4 or 5 questions a month, you get an answer to them, you know, and you and they have to answer the elected members in terms of that. I was deferred back to a report, I don't know how many times over the last couple of months, and it was being done purposely because of questions that I was asking. But, you know, the report has changed, and the reason why this report, like, there was always a homeless report onto the agenda of the council, but the level of reporting was very, very bad. And every month I'd go back and say, no, this is not good enough. This needs to be on a report. We need to know. We want this added. And it was a case that, you know, even the situation around the non-nationals and Romanians and EU, there was systemic racism going on within the report. And as soon as I highlighted that, 2 months later, that was taken out of the report. The homeless deaths was put in, then it was taken back out the next month. And I asked the question again, what's the situation? Why haven't we got a report on the homeless deaths? Oh, we'll add it in, it was added the next. So there's no real kind of consistency in how they report anything. And, you know, like Leash is 100% right. There's no kind of, like, if somebody died, if so many people had died in the same hospital or the same ward in the matter in 3 days, or three people within a day had died, you know, that you would hear something about that. You don't hear anything about people, like, you know, and again, you are in a social care setting. If people died in crèches, if people died in nursing homes, if people died in hospitals, you would hear people died, you know, but we have to go and actually pull the teeth out of people to get the fact that, you know, and like I've seen some of the questions that Leisha's put in, she's seen questions I put in, and, you know, they have to officially answer me. Leisha's wait 21 days sometimes for questions to be answered, you know, just to get out. It's ridiculous. But they see it's, I think it's a matter of kind of the public narrative as well, and their own, you know, that it's always bad press in terms of the DRHG. It has been for so long, and it's been ran absolutely diabolically and you know, some of the management have put their hand up and said, okay, look, we do need to do things better. You know, particularly over the last month since the former director has gone, I'll be honest, good riddance. You know, we need a fresh set of voice in there, and we need a new way of dealing with things. But I just think that how we've shown not even only deaths, the whole reporting system within the RHE is just unbelievably bad. Really, really.
Leisha, you're nodding in agreement.
Yeah,
there.
There's a real issue here, I suppose, people do need to be aware of, is just the amount of, like, misleading and false information that's coming out in the report.
Be bad.
The councillors, it's actually unbelievable. Like, where the RTÉ Investigates did that local connection thing, you know, Anthony had been raising that issue for months in the council.
They interviewed me for 45 minutes and didn't put me on for it whatsoever. Like, they used everything that I had, every silver bullet that I garnered over the last 8 months, they used it all and then wouldn't put me on the fucking screen. Like, crazy.
Well, he's getting official responses to say that it wasn't happening. I mean, at one stage, there was a rule in place that you have to be seen to be sleeping rough before you could be accommodated.
Yeah, bad.
And then it was that you had to be seen to be sleeping rough 3 times before you could be accommodated.
And the how bad that was, that one guy was actually outside Starbucks up on College Green, and he was in a sleeping bag on the ground, and whether he went to go to the toilet or he'd moved out of the sleeping bag, he was waiting on assertive outreach to actually arrive to him. When they arrived, he wasn't in the sleeping bag, and they reported he wasn't in the sleeping bag, and he had to wait another 3 days for them to, and I couldn't believe this. I was like, jeez, this just could. And like myself and Louisa were ringing around, and they were telling me, no, this doesn't happen. And then, like, I'm ringing and asking to go out and visit people, and they would not allow you to register. So one thing that was said was, it's the only, well, look, you know, I've heard how other countries roll out homeless services, seen how other countries roll out homeless services, but we're the only country, I believe, that actually make you become homeless, and, you know, before we will actually provide you with a service. So, like, even if you know in 2 weeks' time, Rory, you're going to lose your house and you're going to be on the street with your family, God forbid. And, well, they tell you, well, see the day that you're walking out the house with your bed and your back and your wardrobes and all the baggage and 4 kids in tow, pop up to Parkgate Hall and we deal with you then, you know. So then you're physically there in front of them and you're okay, what do we do now? And the first thing they'll ask you, is there anybody else you can stay with? This is the first question that they ask you. And I'm like, okay, if I had someone else to stay with, you know, I certainly wouldn't be coming up here knocking on your door. And then it's a situation where, and this comes from people that we're dealing with every day of the week, that you're discouraged to go in. You know, they're going to do everything they can in that room with you to discourage you from trying to access homeless services. even tell you that you have to go away and they'll ring you in the afternoon and leave you till 8 o'clock. And look, Rory, we saw this, people being sent to Garda stations, you know, people being left late at 9 o'clock, people having to sleep on the floor of my office over the years because there was no hotel room available because the rugby was on in the fucking city. Like, it was crazy, absolutely crazy. But, you know, I don't think that's went away altogether. I think we're still in a situation where, if anything, we're going to see that tsunami of everything coming back over the next, like, and particularly the quicker we talk about opening up the economy and letting everybody back in and getting the hotels open, like, we're definitely not out of dark waters at the moment.
Yeah. Leisha, do you want to just talk a little bit more maybe about that in terms of the statistics you were talking about and the difficulty of getting that and the presentation of it?
Yeah, I suppose, well, like, it was, Anthony raised the issue of the local connection a long time ago and the issue of this thing of getting letters from the outreach team for to prove that you're sleeping rough. So, you know, it was being put into reports, council reports, for example, that there were no refusals, that no one had been refused a bed. This was probably around the same time that RT were doing their research. That was a brilliant program that they did, even if Anthony wasn't in it, which was a big mistake, obviously. But it was a great program. Like, it was, the people that they got were really good. But, like, that was all going on. And that was all being raised within the council by Anthony throughout the time that all of that was happening for months. And, like, he got a report at one stage that outlined eligibility criteria for homeless services. That wasn't in it. Eventually, it got to the stage that Louisa Santoro, the CEO of Mendicity, had to produce an email, which actually said that even if you got the three letters from the outreach team to prove that you were sleeping rough on three separate occasions, you still wouldn't be accommodated because the person in question didn't have a local connection. But, you know, if there's rules in place for people to access accommodation, or if there's rules in place for accommodation, we just need to be honest about what they are.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very hard to kind of see about how you can improve services when you don't know whether or not somebody's entitled to access them. And then with the quality standards within the hostels as well, it's been the same thing. It's been something that's been brought up again and again. And it's like, well, what supports are people getting? So we've been getting it directly from the council and from the minister that the quality standards framework applies in all hostels, including private. And I've been told that consistently. Other people have been told it consistently. And only the week before last, the manager, Dublin City Council manager, admitted in the Dáil Housing Committee that none of those standards are in place in private hostels and that none of the 1,500 single homeless people who are in private hostels have a support plan.
Sure.
So that's a huge admission for all of what we hear about all the supports that people are getting. You know, they're not, or half of them are not. And again, that's been, you know, misinformation from the top, from the Department of Housing and everything. So
would you say not one of the 1,500 single people who are in private emergency accommodation have a support plan?
He said most of them don't.
Most of them don't.
That, what they done was then every month I check manager's orders, and years ago I was told on the council the manager's orders used to come over in paper to City Hall, and you could go through all of the managers. So basically every decision that's made has to be signed off on a manager's order and it's referenced by number. And I'd be going through them now monthly by email, and I'd be looking at the requests, so much of the manager's orders. And what I'm seeing is now that, you know, there's activation of support teams to be put into these hostels. But it's only happened since we've raised it over the last 4 months, and even the fact, and it's on a very low level. But something that happened, and look, I've called this out before, and I've no problem calling it out again. The big players, the four big players within the industry, and that's what it is an industry, for years have been getting paid for what's called on-site support. So if we go back to 2016, 2017, 2018, in terms of the expenditure for homeless services within Dublin, although we were paying, let's just say, Rory Hearn's B&B, and we were paying to have people in there, we were paying the NGOs to provide what was called on-site support. Yet those that were on-site and those that were living there were telling us that in some cases they hadn't seen anybody since they were placed 18 or 19 months ago, in one individual case. So, and then they came out and said that they hadn't got key workers. No, we don't provide key workers, is what was said. but we wanted the major players at one stage. And I'm like, hang on a second, but what's all this onside support? Because it's come to about the tune of 11 million this year that we, you know, and can you break down exactly what this onside support is? You know, have they got mental health teams? Have they got people, you know, that would put an exit plan? And look, we've been screaming now for a long time in terms of exit plan. The first thing that you should do when you went to homeless services is register. The second thing you should do is get an exit plan, all right? And Owen O'Brien has said this for a long, long time, that you shouldn't be any more than 6 months within homeless services. It can be done, but it needs the will in order to do it.
And just on that, in terms of, you know, because the key and what, you know, all of this conversation again shows, you know, the extremely damaging impacts of, you know, spending time being on the streets or emergency accommodation. And that, you know, as you say, people need an exit plan. They don't just need an exit plan. They need an exit. They need a home, you know, and that the issue of, for example, housing first. And we've seen the, you know, the government and the city is rolling out housing first. But in terms of your, what?
Housing what?
Exactly. The question is.
That's what it should be called.
Housing what?
Housing last. That's what.
Housing last.
Yeah.
But there is, it's been raised that the it's not working, that the numbers in it aren't being, you know, reached. So what's your analysis of how Housing First is working, Leisha?
Well, I wouldn't probably know as much as Anthony, but I can certainly tell you that, I mean, I meet guys all the time who've been homeless and they're from Dublin and they've been homeless in the Dublin region for like 10, 15 years more. So I'd suggest it's not working. I would wonder as well, and I'd really query Rory, when we see the struggle that people have to get mental health supports, what level of mental health supports are those, that small number of people who have got the Housing First programme, are they really getting the intensive mental health supports that they would get if they were in Finland or in the Housing First programme in New York? Because I know what the public sector is like, or if you're public health, what you're going to get in terms of mental health supports in general, it's not going to be much. So unless the homeless person is getting all of that support, then they're not getting the full Housing First package. Mm-hmm. And, you know, obviously it's not going to work. It's got to be intensive support. I did ask Bob Jordan before about the number of key clients that each of those workers has. I think 12 clients is a lot for one worker. I don't think you can give really intensive support at that level. I think that's average level support, not really intensive. So I would have some queries. I do agree with the principle of the program, obviously. I think it's brilliant. Yeah. But I would have questions about what way it's been delivered here and whether or not it's working. And then also, I suppose, it's just a numbers game. You know, it just doesn't seem that the majority of people are able to access it. There isn't enough houses. It comes back to the old problem with housing. But, you know, unfortunately, what it's come to now is everybody just says now, oh, it's housing-led. Responses, housing-led solutions. So when you're asking about like quality standards in hostels, you know, homeless people would say to me, why aren't the hostels separated anymore into like wet hostels and dry hostels? No, they know themselves. They've been around services long enough. They know themselves that services are getting worse. The quality in hostels is getting worse. And homeless people know that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you can talk about housing-led solutions, but I think we're about a million miles away.
Mm. Yeah, no, I think that's a big question. And have you seen any statistics on Housing First, Anthony, and how much housing has it delivered? And
I have a report on it. They said they are meeting their targets. I'm not sure what their targets are. It was like 900 or something over a couple of years, over 3 years or something like that, which was or less. It was either more. It was an extended period of time or a less amount that were actually delivered. But either way. Look, it's again, housing last. Like let's compare it to the EU and Ireland paying the most in terms of interest on mortgage rates. Let's compare it to China being able to build roads quicker than, you know, Jackie Healy Ray down the country. You know, that's what Housing First is here. It's a situation that it's a fantastic idea. I've spent time in Finland. I was there. I saw how it's done. I think it's, you know, if it was being rolled out by the right people, it would absolutely do fabulous. But what we, again, I'll go back to the industry we created in homelessness. You know, we've got one of the biggest charities being one of the biggest landlords, one of the biggest landlords in the country now at the moment. But yet the same model is being used in Finland and the charity is the biggest landlord, and they've managed to eradicate it. But instead of eradicating it here, what we keep doing is we keep increasing the amount of people that come into homeless services. But then again, in regard to the wraparound supports, like, it doesn't state within the Housing Force report at all that, you know, the appropriate mental health support services are being applied to the individuals that have went through. Like, I remember one individual that was brought in. He was given a flat in an area that I live in, and he was being dealt with by the support team. Now, this man needed, I would say, at least somebody check in with him every day of the week, and our teams were going to do it. He ended up back out on the streets, but not before he ended up sleeping in the tent on the bed in his bedroom. So that will tell you that that man wasn't being checked in the appropriate manner by the team that should have been doing it. But in terms of the rolling out of it, we funded all of the different counties now. And something O'Brien has been, you know, harping on about is the fact that we're funding all these different counties now for a Housing Force-led approach. We haven't got Housing Force right in one county. So why are we rolling it out in all the other counties? You know, we need to have a there's no set way. The budget on homeless services, Rory, the budget on mental health in homeless services, I think it was 2019, for mental health supports was 400,000, and we spent 300,000 out of it. So we didn't even spend the total amount of money applied to mental health support. So, you know, again, it's like everything else within, in my opinion, in the DRHE and Dublin City Council providing homeless services. We need a total overhaul on it. We need to throw the book out the window, and we need to start again. And we need to start again with people that actually, you know, are not working for an industry, people that actually want to eradicate homelessness rather than keep maintaining and sustaining it.
I think that's a pretty... you know, it's a damning statement in many ways, do you know what I mean, in a situation that, you know, really, you know, as you say, requires, you know, complete overhaul. And it does come back to as well, and maybe we finish on this, just the issue of housing. That I know what you're saying, Leisha, around, you know, people are saying it's housing, you know, it's housing led and it's housing solutions. But the issue ultimately is housing, that if you don't have secure housing, and I know an issue has to be as well, that a lot of this, you know, housing first, and again, it'd be interesting to see the figures on this, how many are going into private rental accommodation that's, you know, a year lease, 6 month lease that isn't secure. And so that raises the issue, you know, back to how much public housing, how much social housing, how much cost rental housing are we building? And one of the topics that's come up recently is the whole issue of the Oscar Traynor site. And we've seen a lot of criticism by the government parties of the left opposition, and of course, which included actually Fianna Fáil councillors voting against that bill, or not that bill, sorry, the plan, the public-private partnership plan. But we're seeing a new plan being developed now. Anthony, do you want to maybe just update where is that at now? And well, do you see that being
in terms of the new plan, the new, like, you know, something that I had said at that meeting was, and you know, when, and we keep getting this threat from management in regard to, well, we won't see build in this side of 7 years and this, that, you know.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether, I think it was Leisha or it was another reporter that had asked me the question, and you know, it came out in the papers the next day and said, no, we will see build because the manager is going to be instructed to build, because see this ethos and narrative of them telling us what to do. Well, that's out the window. I'm sorry. No, you get paid to do your job and we get paid to oversee you doing that job. So there's no more of you dictating to us in regard to that land. And in fairness, from, you know, we've got great cross-party support bar the Blue Shirts in regard to a proper, fully funded public housing model being put on that land. And you know, the willingness, I believe, is there. And the only reason why management are pulling their finger out is because the pressure has come from the elected members in terms of actually putting a proper plan, which then has, you know, the minister, I fear that, you know, obviously with the Land Development Agency and whatever else, the powers and trying to strip our powers in regard to selling off of lands, that we could enter into a whole different quorum or angle in terms of this down the line. But, you know, in regard to putting together, there's the serious, serious pressure from the elected members now at the moment, in particular the left members. In regards to Fianna Fáil basically had a decision made at council. I don't think the minister even knew about this decision that was going to be made in regard to them voting. They put an amendment in. Their amendment was voted down on the night. But the reason why was because, you know, there's an elected member out there that gets a pat on the head and, you know, told, well, it's a situation here where that elected member told the rest of the party that he wanted them to vote in that manner, because the local out there, and it was led by John Lyons. John Lyons done an absolutely fantastic job. Jesus, I tell you, if John Lyons had been standing beside me in Audley Gardens, you know, for what he'd done on that, I think we might have got over the line. But we're in a situation where there really is a direction here. There's will from everybody in terms of, you know, coming together and actually putting a property public fund. And now, like, the minister's come out the last couple of days with, you know, cost rental plans and included housing now are being dragged in regard to providing cost rental and stuff like that. So I do think the minister is under serious pressure. He can't, but look, he's not closing all the loopholes either. We look at the co-living situation as well. So many of them have got in. I've seen, I think it was about 15 SHD proposals in front of me in the last 3 weeks where they're all coming in the back door since he made that ruling. But I do think that the plan going forward is that we will see a proper 100% you know, plan put there, and the management have to do what they're told. Simple as, you know, it's either you do what you're told or we just get on with it without you. Simple as that.
Do you think this is very significant, Leisha, in terms of this public, affordable public rental plan being developed, the alternative Oscar Traynor plan? And do you think that the minister and the government are likely to be pressured into supporting it?
I don't know. I mean, on the one hand, he's talking about the taking away the powers as well, isn't he, with the land management, the land development agency. So I suppose it's one of those power struggles that would be kind of interesting to watch. I mean, the function of the Land Development Agency seems to be like the mass privatization of public land. So they're going to be taking on all of the public sites nearly, and then building some proportion of social housing on them and building mostly private housing on them. That's my understanding of it. Like with the Audebney Gardens thing, I think, from what I recall, I think originally Fine Gael wanted only 10% social housing on that site, on a publicly owned site. So, you know, the strange and all as the deal that was done in the end was, it was a long way from what Simon Coveney had proposed at the time. He was the housing minister at the time. So, it remains to be seen, Rory. I can't
remember. There's still no planning permission on Audebney Gardens.
Oh, yes,
that's another issue. And in terms of the Land Development Agency, Rory, it's NAMA on steroids. That's exactly what it is. Like, it's like the crazy frog running around the room. That's what it's going to do. It's going to come in and whip up all and any land that's available there, and it's going to try and sell it off to private developers and use the this whole PR gig of social houses actually being built. But ultimately, when we look at the level of social housing that's being built in some of the bigger sites, like even, you know, out down the road from me here in like Spencer Dock, and like they're not getting, there's no social housing coming out of any of the bills that are coming or that are coming forward. Like they've literally, they're using any and every excuse not to have to put social housing on any of the sites that are being built. And whether that's pay the council off in some manner, or build sites somewhere else outside of, like, Spencer Dock, for instance, they're not going to give an apartment down there that's worth 500,000 to somebody that's coming in on social housing. What they do is they build two houses somewhere else up the road in Darndale, and they give them to them there if they can get that proper land. So, but the Land Development Agency is going to be very, very bad. It's going to be very bad for us. And I think I know there's a motion in front of the council for myself and Tina McVeigh in regard to it that's to be confirmed tomorrow, an emergency motion.
Well, I think it is going to be very interesting to watch how this develops, and to, I think, not just to watch, but actually try and, essentially stop this, because it is, it's the complete wrong use of public land. And, you know, I've made this point from the outset that, you know, and you know, I know all of you agree that public land is a resource, and it's a finite resource, and it should be used.
And we're telling us last night, though, Rory, that we've none left. Like at the meeting last night, he's telling us we've none left. We're going to run out of land in two years as well. Like Kenny has said this last night at a public meeting, that we'll have no land left in 2 to 3 years, which is totally at odds with what the likes of Mel Reynolds and stuff are saying, you know. So, like,
the reality is there is state land banks. The local authorities have a certain amount of land, and I don't believe that the Dublin City Council are in a position where they will be running out of land.
Yeah.
But there's two things. One is that there's huge state land banks, which are held by public bodies. And obviously the LDA, you're right, is getting access to those and been transferred those. But the other thing is you can always CPO land. You know, land is there, and
you don't use those powers.
if you put high enough tax on vacant land as well. And I was very interested. I was talking to someone from Vienna in one of the podcasts yesterday, and they said that what they do on all private developments now is that 2/3 of the development, that's 2/3, 66% of a private development has to be affordable housing and social housing. Mm-hmm. And so I think the idea that, oh, you know, this, the local authorities are running out of land quickly is not, it's another red herring in my view. It's trying to take the pressure off from saying, oh, we can't do this. But ultimately, I think there is a real battle to be had, and a real, you know, we need to get to the point where the funding needs to be put up, like for the likes of Oscar Traynor, by central government.
And the affordable rental housing has to be affordable. If you're talking about 25% discount from market rate, well, market rate on an apartment might be $2,000 a month. Mm. So then your 25% discount is going to bring you down to 2 grand a month. You'd bring you down to 1600 a month.
Yeah.
That's still not affordable for people on average salaries.
No, it's not.
You know, it's pointless calling something affordable rental if it's not actually going to be affordable. I mean, and the whole Vienna model is totally different because it's all based on the cost of building. They build, they get good value for building, and then they can rent things out at cost. We don't seem to be interested in going down that.
Seeing of all the builders, we're never going to get good value for building here. That's the problem.
If you control enough of the market, you do. And that's the whole point. You have to say that actually we're going to take control back from the market. And that's the big thing. But listen, we could talk all night about this. We could create a 24-hour housing podcast channel. Yeah. But listen, Anthony Flynn from Inner City Help and Homeless and Leisha Nealon from Dublin Inquirer, thank you so much for joining me on Reboot. And we will have you back very, very soon again.
Thanks, Rory.
Thank you, Rory.
And a reminder to our listeners that if you can in any way support, donate to Inner City Help and Homeless, who do fantastic work. And their website, innercityhelpinghomeless.ie, isn't that right, Anthony?
Oh, I see, www.ichh.ie. We shortened it, was too long.
ICHH.ie. And I know it's a difficult time in terms of volunteers and with COVID, but I know if you are interested in volunteering as well, to contact them and let them know. And hopefully when things do open up a bit after we get to zero COVID and we get zero COVID in place, then volunteers will be taken on board to be not just managing homeless, but actually building homes to end homelessness. And Leisha Nealon, Dublin Inquirer, of course, check out the Dublin Inquirer. Fantastic publication that's producing great stuff. Support it if you can, and if you've any money left over or time, you can come and support us in patreon.com/tortoiseshack to help us keep going. Thank you very much, and we'll talk to you soon.